You are leading the educational session?
Yes. So we have an education session about the Brown Act, and that's the open meetings laws requirements that local public agencies in the state of California are subject to. And we like to do this presentation periodically to make sure that we're reminded of the rules and see if there's any questions. This is an ongoing obligation, so we have to make sure that we're continuously remembering these rules and understanding them. The open meetings laws have two main basic premises behind them. One is the idea of notice to the public. Provide notice ahead of time to the public about what it is that the board will be considering. The other basic notion behind the open meetings laws is an opportunity to be heard, providing to the public the opportunity to be heard.
Karen, it just struck me that prior to our break, I asked if Tim Price might have anything he wanted to say quickly before he left to join the session of the conference.
Oh, sure.
Tim, are you here?
I am. And unfortunately, the trustees left the phone on mute, so when I tried to jump in, phone wasn't working. But just a real few quick comments. Bear with me one moment.
Yes, go ahead.
We have Osprey is going over at the moment. a few quick previews for the next meeting. We are anticipating having a presentation from Ocean Avenue, one of our private equity managers, presenting along with the staff recommendation for investing in their next fund. We will have the quarterly investment report presented by Veris. And then just a reminder that staff and Veris are working together on fine-tuning the two requested investment strategies into actual implementable asset allocations that will be presented to the board on December 2nd. So it looks like everything is proceeding at pace, and we should be in good shape to finalize all the asset allocation decisions on December 2nd.
Okay. Any quick questions of Tim? Thank you.
Okay. I will sign off here then.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Karen, thank you for...
Thank you, of course. Okay, so the CICERA board is subject to...
I hope that will continue.
Yeah. ...is subject to the Brown Act requirements for holding open meetings. Can anyone tell me what the two main basic notions behind the Brown Act are?
Transparency.
Transparency. What does transparency mean?
Making sure things aren't done behind closed doors that the public is not aware of.
Mm-hmm. So the meeting has to be open and the public should be able to attend. Can they speak?
Yes.
Yes. So one of the things is making sure that the public has an opportunity to participate, to speak, to make public comment. And is there a requirement that they know ahead of time what it is that the public body
want to give them
is
notice.
About? Okay, so very good. So that's how I started this. Notice and an opportunity to be heard. Just keep those two things in mind, and all these rules will make sense. Once you dive into these rules, they get a little bit technical and can get lost. But just keep in mind that the public has a right to know what it is in advance that the board will be considering, and also the meetings themselves should be open and the public should be afforded an opportunity to make comment. So the purpose of the Brown Act is to ensure that the public agency actions are taken openly, but also that the public agency deliberations are done openly. We talked about the key concepts. The retirement board meetings must be open and accessible to the public. A board meeting agenda must be posted publicly, and the Brown Act does require that it's posted physically outside the building and also on the internet website, at least 72 hours before the meeting. And that applies to standing committees as well. Remember, we recently established a standing audit committee. Those meetings are subject to the same exact rules in terms of being having to be open and having notice be posted ahead of time of the agenda. And lastly, during the board meeting, the public must be given an opportunity to comment. So what is a meeting of the retirement board? What we're doing today, this meeting in person, is a meeting. We had two trustees participating telephonically. Their presence is essentially part of this meeting as well. It is defined as a congregation of a majority of the retirement board. In this case, it would be five trustees at the same place and location, including teleconference locations, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item within the retirement board's subject matter jurisdiction. Serial meetings. There could be a serial meeting happening if you have communication from board member A to board member B, but then board member B takes that information and communicates to member C, and so on, and you end up having five trustees having this serial meetings talking about an issue that is within the subject matter of this board. That should happen in an open meeting where notice was given to the public about this item and the public was able to attend and was given an opportunity to comment. So serial meetings are to be avoided. The Brown Act also covers attendance and conferences, and those could qualify as meetings as well. So we do have some conferences that we know are open to the public. They're not necessarily free to the public. There could be a charge for attending, but so long as they're free, meaning that the public has access to them, we can have a majority of the board attend. But the board members should not be conducting meetings there among themselves, among other trustees, discussing the subject matter jurisdiction within the CSERA. The Brown Act also allows the attendance of purely social events as well. So things like a funeral or a party is allowed. And again, a majority of the retirement board members should not be discussing among themselves business that is within the subject matter of the retirement board. The agenda requirement we talked about briefly earlier, that must be posted at least 72 hours before a regular meeting of the retirement board, and it must contain a general description of each item of business to be transacted, including items to be discussed, and the time and location of the meeting must be posted in a public location and on the CSERA website. So the agenda lists the items that the board will be discussing, and if the agenda doesn't list an item, then we can't discuss it. There's some exceptions to that. Under trustee comments or staff comments, the board can raise something that is not on the agenda briefly and provide direction and ask for a report, for example, or ask for work to be done on that issue, even though it's not on the agenda. We mentioned that earlier. Also, during each meeting of the retirement board, the board must allow public comments on each agenda item and on other matters within the jurisdiction of the board. So we just talked about open meetings and allowing access to the public to attend, but there are exceptions to that. The Brown Act does list a few situations where the board is authorized to meet in closed session. And we do that routinely with situations that involve pending litigation against the system, the board conferring with legal counsel about whether to initiate litigation. We also have disability determinations that are done in closed session, and that's under the personnel exception of the Brown Act that allows holding a closed session on those matters. With Sisera becoming an independent employer recently, we've also had closed sessions where the board confers with its negotiator regarding labor relations, both salaries and benefits. What's discussed in closed session is strictly confidential. Board members may not disclose confidential information acquired by being present in a closed session to a person not entitled to receive that information.
And that raises an interesting issue from my seat, and it came up not because of something on this board, but on another authority I serve on, which, where I'm representing the County Board of Supervisors, that do have an interest in the litigation that was pending. What is our policy in here with regard to me revealing to the Board of Supervisors anything that takes place in closed session, or is it truly just a case-by-case example? Do we have a written policy?
We don't have a written policy, but it would be confidential information that you obtained from a closed session here, so you'd not be able to disclose it.
Okay, because apparently some boards, there's language that allows those who are representing a board to share information, but we don't have any policy.
Those representing a board in terms of...
For example, I'm using the example, this came up on a solid waste authority issue, that Karen Mitchoff and I both serve on the solid waste authority. We're in settlement discussions regarding an issue with one of our haulers, and she wanted to disclose it to the full Board of Supervisors in closed session, and County Council said, well, in some instances you're allowed to, depending upon the bylaws of that other board, and as you are there representing the Board of Supervisors, you in some instances are allowed to go back and get input as to what they think we should settle for, or make, you know, in essence, make summaries of what happened. But we don't have anything that allows for that on our board.
No, we don't.
Okay.
We go by the statute that prohibits the sharing of information in that situation. Thank you. That's a great question. Are there any other questions?
Related to that, she doesn't represent the Board of Supervisors.
No,
right?
And it's a little bit, I'm appointed by the Board of Supervisors, so it's a little bit different, whereas the Solid Waste Authority, I appointed to represent.
Sure.
So it, that may be the distinction.
Yeah. Any other questions so far? Consequences of violating the Brown Act. There's possible criminal liability for individual board members. There's civil remedies. Civil remedy would be an action to stop, prevent, or invalidate an action of the board if it was taken in violation of the Brown Act. And attorney's fees and costs awarded to the plaintiff.
Karen, are you aware of any circumstance where a board member was found criminally liable under the Brown Act for failing to meet its provisions?
I'm not aware of any situation, but I haven't fully researched it. But that's a really interesting question. I'll see what I can find and see if there's anything published about that type
of
situation.
I asked that in part because one of the rules buried in ERISA, obviously only tangentially ties to us, is a 5-year jail term for failing to file a Form 5500, knowingly, of course. Mm-hmm. No, these are the kinds of sort of draconian penalties that get put in laws, but as a practical matter, aren't real.
It's a really interesting issue to investigate and see if there's any reported cases on that.
There are.
There are. Oh, Ryan knows. That's right, because the DA is involved in those.
Is there anything you'd like to admit to, John?
Really curiosity.
Is there a published one that you can discuss,
criminal cases are very rare. And I couldn't tell you one that has been prosecuted all the way through where somebody's been criminally punished. Generally, they end up settling and things are all worked out and put back to where they were before the violation occurred. But there is the potential. That's the way the statute's written, there is the potential.
So, consequences of violating the Brown Act in terms of civil remedies, any person may commence an action by mandamus or injunction for the purpose of obtaining a judicial determination that an action taken by a legislative body of a local agency is null and void if they can show that there was a Brown Act violation. Prior to commencing the action, the person must make a demand of the board to cure or correct the action, and that's important because that allows the agency to correct and cure what's happened. And whether or not there was a violation, typically the best course of action is to have that item be put on a future agenda properly and have a full discussion about the item, allow the public to make comment, and then make that a decision based on that. And that would be a cure to alleged violation of the Brown Act. And a court may award attorney fees and costs to the prevailing plaintiff. So if the plaintiff who says, alleges that there was a Brown Act violation, if they prevail and the court agrees with them, the court may award attorney fees, so the agency would have to pay the attorney fees on behalf of that plaintiff. And a court may award attorney fees and costs to a defendant public agency if the court finds that the action against the agency for alleged Brown Act violation was frivolous and lacking in merit. I would think that that's probably very rare, but it's there. Are there any questions?
How might that work? For example, we did clearly hear I believe there was no hopeless on the Arinda Moraga Fire District, that the district in dealing with Chief Nowicki, in fact, through those dealings violated the Brown Act. How would somebody then sue? Who would that likely be? What would the request be by reason of the suit? I'm just trying to put this.
Any member of the public has the right to bring an action.
So if an attorney, for example, wanted to effectively generate legal fees, they can find a local resident who was willing to file a suit. The attorney represents the local resident. The attorney generates fees in the process of suing the district, and then would require, upon the appropriate finding, of course, that the district had to pay the attorney.
I'm not sure if it even has to be a local resident. It doesn't. I don't think the party that can bring suit even has to be affected by the decision or the violation, or whether they don't have to live in the district or anything like that. It's basically, I believe it's anybody.
Any person.
Yeah.
I guess I'm going far afield, but these things do pop up. Can the attorney then legally share part of the legal costs with the individual plaintiff bringing suit? In other words, is there something built in once you start down the path of you're in violation of the Brown Act that makes it economically viable for people to sue?
Well, you correct, I mean, once you know you're doing something wrong, you correct it, but you're saying, normally, I think when people sue, it's because they want you to correct your action.
And you're refusing to do so.
If you're ongoing refusing to do so, then
I'm looking at something that's all done, Chief Nowicki, just as our specific example.
And that's an interesting one because you do the evaluations in closed session and you direct people to negotiate. Yeah, I mean that's a whole other. It may be someone's interpretation of the Brown Act, that gets you in that position. But I don't know if people would be suing for financial gain. I guess that was sort of my takeaway, is would someone really be suing for financial gain? I don't see that. I see it as...
Only if they were able to share in legal fees.
Yeah.
That's really what was my cycle of thinking.
I guess you could, but if it was a past misconduct, I don't know how far you'd get, other than having the district say we're taking corrective action and the court saying thank you, you know, move onward. Because I don't know your damages. I'm just trying to think of what sort of relief you would be seeking if you were suing them based on a past Brown Act violation.
By highlighting it, the district's voters would do a better job next time of electing board members.
I'm trying to think of what loss. I mean, I could see a district attorney prosecuting them for violating the Brown Act, but do we see someone's, I don't know, that have you ever seen?
You know, most of the ones that we've dealt with have resulted from a private citizen complaining about an action, and it generally turns out that there isn't a violation there
after the full investigation. Okay.
Right? There's only a suspicion. But, I mean, you've got a couple of things here. An attorney could bring action, a Brown Act action, on his own. He doesn't really even need a client. He's a member of the public. And in
so
theory,
his fees,
get
okay.
his fees paid by mm-hmm. the violating body.
If he prevails, yeah.
All right.
Then you've got the other situation where the Brown Act violation actually causes harm to an individual. And they sue both for a Brown Act violation and for actual damages, which is an unusual situation. But
mm-hmm. well, maybe, yeah, you know, let's just not find ourselves in that situation.
Right. any other questions of Karen?
So that's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you.